Welcome, I'm Joseph Paris, and you're listening to another episode of State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat between me and an industry leader. Today, I invite to the session of State of Readiness, Dr. Morphis Chalikidis. Morphis is an experienced professional in the field of operational excellence, whom I've known for a great many years and with whom I've shared the stage at several conferences. His passion is for helping organizations develop their in-house capabilities and continuous improvement, tools, techniques, and mindset. Presently, he is the founder of Morphis Consulting, a consultancy that helps organizations improve their operational performance. Prior to starting his own firm, he was a regional operational excellence director and business transformation at AXA. He has worked with companies of various sizes, ranging from 150 to over 3,000 employees and with revenues from 80 million to over 2.5 billion euros, and has experience in Latin America, Europe, Middle East, and Africa. Morphis earned his PhD at Lancaster University, studying the effects of Lean Six Sigma deployment on organizational learning and knowledge creation, and his master's in management science and operational research from Warwick Business School at the University of Warwick. Welcome, Morphis. How are you doing today?
Thank you very much, JP. I'm very happy to be here. We go a couple of years now, so and have always been saying about having this opportunity to talk and exchange on our experiences. So I'm pretty happy that we managed to organize it in the end.
Yeah, this has been great. You know, you and I have, as I mentioned in the intro, shared the stage at several conferences. In fact, I believe the first conference that we shared was in Berlin. And right before this, as a matter of fact, I was speaking to one of our other, cohorts in arms, their comrades in arms, from that very conference.
I have your book, State of Readiness.
And now books aren't inherently useful unless you actually read it. Have you read it?
Yeah, a couple of times actually, because you read it once, then you say, I need to read it again and reflect and think about the different points. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So here it is now, the beginning of August in 2020. And, the world has been transformed over the last few months with the COVID pandemic. You know, how have you seen yourself adapting to it and those out in the field, especially in continuous improvement?
Well, an interesting point, an interesting experience maybe, because we talk about change and we talk about how we adapt to change and how we deal with different situations. And it's all about how you see, how you prepare yourself. Well, when it hits you so hard with like COVID-19, you adapt you have to adapt because there's no other option. You cannot say, I'm going to visit people. I cannot run classrooms. So you have to move to how business has been doing now, go more online, trying to organize virtual meetings, and then see how things will evolve, basically. This is where you show your flexibility.
Yeah. You know, in my book, I talk about disruptors, and I talk about credible disruptors and non-credible disruptors. And a non-credible disruptor I define as somebody that does not, or somebody or something, does not have truly destructive powers. So we talk about transformation and change. And, you know, usually what happens is that we have, you know, step incremental evolution. But a credible disruptor is something that's got truly destructive power. You know, a new CEO coming in. You know, they got carte blanche, they can do whatever they want. And an acquisition of a company or selling your company to another. Being acquired, that is, you know, that's transformational. You know, a global economic meltdown or a global pandemic are transformational. These are things that are completely beyond your ability to influence. The only thing that you could do is cope. And, you know, with this pandemic, it's amazing to me how quickly most companies did make the transformation from working at the office to working from home. Interestingly, probably the vast majority of the people I've talked to have said that productivity has increased. Very few people have said it stayed the same, and nobody has told me that productivity has decreased as a result of having worked from home. Now, a year ago, if we had made the same argument, everybody should work from home, most companies would say, absolutely not. We're not going to do that, you know, for whatever reason. But it's funny how people are transformed when they're forced to transform.
That's true. That's true. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And actually, I think it will take a bit of time, I think, until things stabilize, because you are absolutely right. The disruptor was a credible one. You have no other option. That's the way to go forward. But teams do not necessarily learn how to collaborate virtually just like that in 2 or 3 months. So eventually, I think we will see a period that we'll need to adapt, change the habits in order this good performance that you said not to be the honeymoon period, but be sustainable over a period of time. So it will be interesting to see how things are going to evolve.
Yeah. Now, what has been your experience with CI programs and OPEX programs that you've seen out in the field?
My background goes, my experience goes back to my early years in Land Rover, when we were deploying CI programs. Every company with their own names, or every year with a different name, Lean Six Sigma, Lean Management, Operational Excellence. I had the opportunity to see how, both professionally, how it was implemented and what kind of difficulties it encountered in different countries, but also as part of my PhD research, as you mentioned, I had the opportunity to step out of my bubble, which is always helpful, and see what is happening to organizations as an external observer. And this is when you start discovering things or seeing things that maybe they were in front of you and you were not able to see them before. I give an example that probably we are going to elaborate a bit more later. Any book you pick up, any research paper you pick up, people immediately blame leadership. And they say it's leadership's fault that things don't work. Yes, you need to have leadership support in order to achieve a program. But if you don't have leadership support, this is a kind of a symptom. It's not the root cause. So you need to dig deeper and try to understand where it's coming from. And this is where you discover a range of things. And as a CI leader, the mistakes that you make that contribute to this kind of lack of support.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point that you make, because, you know, everybody blames leadership for when these programs fail. But, you know, isn't it the responsibility of the people that are heading up these programs to actually understand what is important to leadership?
You know? Exactly. And unfortunately, this is a lesson you learn in tears and through pain. I remember my very first meeting with the CEO of the company that we're talking about CI program. To deploy CI program. And there was a senior executive from headquarters and meeting with that CEO. And instead of understanding the needs of the company, in terms of understanding the strategic priorities and how we can help the company go forward, all the discussion, the first 30 minutes, were about how many people he needs to train, how many people he needs to certify, as if the CEO cares about bells. So things like that, administrative things that the business really doesn't care about. They just want to know how to better serve the customer and how to be more profitable. So can you help them with that? That's what they want to hear.
Right. Well, I think that a lot of, you hit it on the head there. I think a lot of times, you know, people that are running CI programs are concentrating more on the inputs than the outputs. You know, you had made mention about we have to, you know, train these people. Why? Why is the training necessary at all? Okay, I mean, let's just start there, because, you know, everything has a cost, but not everything has a value, right? I mean, we learned that in Lean 101. So if we don't have an actual purpose for the training, except to have to make some net metric, you know, make some quantitative goal, if we're not converting that into some sort of benefit output for the company, I mean, what's the sense, right? You know, I was at an oil and gas company in the Middle East, and I was speaking with their director of OPEX, and he was lamenting to me that he had spent a lot of money getting 60 black belts certified, and they had not completed a project. Now, how can you be a black belt and not complete a project? Let's put that aside for a second. You know, he was building inventory for which there was no purpose.
Yeah.
You know?
You're absolutely right, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that it's really important. You know, training is, you know, important, and you're not going to get anywhere without having the proper people in the proper places with the proper skill sets, right? I mean, and if there's a void in that skill set, then you have to either, you know, you have to fill that void one way or another, either build it from within or hire from outside, whatever it is, you have to fill that void if it's necessary to meet some stated goal. But I think that, you know, oftentimes the metrics of these CI programs are misguided. You know, how many projects did I do this year, right, is a metric. You know, does it matter how many projects that you did or how many actual people that you influenced and, you know, built their problem-solving skills so they can realize opportunities, recognize and realize opportunities themselves? Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, if my KPI is on how many projects I did, then I want to get in and out as fast as possible so I could get on to my next project. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so I'm not actually making any, you know, influencing any change in culture or behavior. I'm firefighting. I'm going from one fire to the next fire to the next fire, and they're disjointed. And this is not an engineered program. This is not a deliberate program. It's just a continuing program. It's not even continuous. It's continuing.
So. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. It's very funny because when we go to help an organization, we talk about waste a lot.
Yeah.
And you use the word inventory and overproduction, things like that. And still, we create a kind of a training factory that we just push people through. And it's fascinating to see the behaviors behind because the CI people, and when I say CI people, I made that mistake myself. Let's be honest. It's like a badge of honor. Look how many people we trained. The managers just send people there as a reward and recognition. Go there. I reward you. You go this fancy training. There's no plan how we're going to use this afterwards. But that's okay because you are happy that I'm sending you for training. And maybe a senior person says, I can't have headquarters bother me every time how many. I just train people and get over with that.
Yeah.
And this creates a kind of a sick environment and a lot of cynicism because if you train people that they do nothing later, people become cynical.
Yeah, absolutely.
And stop believing in you. And then you are wondering, what have I done wrong? Well, you trained people and you did nothing with them.
Right.
this is what you did wrong.
Right.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
You know, and I was at one client, I was conducting a workshop, one of my master classes that I do. And it's a question I ask at every workshop and I wait for an answer. It's one of those questions you ask and then you don't say anything because you want somebody to volunteer. And sometimes those silences could be a little bit awkward, right? And I won't tell you what the person actually said in detail because it might disclose the company that I was doing this workshop at. But I asked them, what does this company want to be in 3 or 5 years' time? What's the vision for this company? And after a moment of quiet, one brave soul said, we want to be the number one, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Yeah. And I said, and everybody agreed. They're nodding their head saying, yeah, we want to be number one. And I said, awesome. What does number one mean? Right? What does number one mean? Now, the person in finance is thinking most profitable. The person attached to sales is thinking the most revenue. The person in marketing is thinking the largest market share. Now, each one of them, independently of themselves, is representative of what number one is. Now, I'm sure the CEO came out of the and said, we want to be the number one, blah, blah, blah. But he wasn't specific enough. He wasn't concise enough. And what everybody heard was how that number one related to them personally, not overall as a company. Right? So you think, you know, as soon as that president says or CEO says, we're going to be the number one, blah, 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 everybody's thinking about that in their own terms and they each go away completely unaligned to the vision of the company. Now, of course, absolutely. You know, in the CEO's mind, number one might be crystal clear. Okay, might be absolutely crystal clear. But and the assumption is that it's so crystal clear that everybody in the audience understood it. And that's not the case. And of course, in the audience, you know, it's a rah-rah moment. And nobody in the audience wants to raise their hand and say, excuse me, what specifically does number one mean? All right, because that takes a lot of guts. But this is, you know, a root cause of the disconnect. Because then everybody goes off doing their own thing, working on their own thing, not working on what's important. I got to share with you, Morph, because I talk to a lot of directors of and vice presidents and a lot of CI people and directors and leaders of CI programs. And I've talked to no less than 40 former CI directors over the last 3 months. Okay, when I say former, they've been recently made former. until February, early March, they were directors of CI. Now they're not. And the CI programs have been largely disbanded, mostly because they weren't working on what was truly important. And I remember this one conversation distinctly with this former director of CI, and he was recently disbanded along with the rest of the program. And I asked him what he was doing. He was talking about improvements, cutting waste, increasing productivity. I said, "Yeah, but what was the growth strategy of the company? Now, what did the company want to achieve?" And he says, "Well, we're growing by acquisition." Okay, think about it. The strategy of the company was to grow by acquiring other companies. Now, after you acquire a company, you have to integrate it into the mothership, right? Into the main company.
Yeah.
Now, if this CI director had reoriented their efforts to not just cutting costs and waste and whatnot, but actually accelerating the integration of the acquired companies into the mothership, okay, that would have been a strategic use of their capabilities. As it was a very tactical or even logistical use of their capabilities. They're making a positive impact, certainly, but they weren't, there was never a wow moment. There was never like, "Oh my God, you guys really helped out the company." Okay. Cause they just weren't working on the prioritization of efforts was misaligned. So what do you see? Do you see that, that people directing CI programs don't understand what's important?
Yeah, you raise a very sensitive topic. This is something I saw when I did my PhD research, because I was able to see the evolution of programs in certain countries, certain companies over a period of 8 years. Okay. And then you try to compare the ones that were killed, replaced, or not replaced at all, but stopped, and everybody repositioned. And those programs that after 8 years not only continued to exist in the organization, but they were respected by the organization. And one thing that struck as the biggest difference between the two is that one evolved in terms of how they understood their mission and what they have to deliver, and the other one did not. Because what was happening, and again goes back to how things were deployed and positioned, people were carrying it like a badge of honor. I remember, "I'm a belt. I'm a black belt. I do only the make projects. I do only these projects. You need to conform with my projects. You need to conform with my terminology. And I don't want to hear anything else." Well, okay, maybe there was a period of time that they were looking a lot about streamlining processes, but now they look for outsourcing. They look for mergers acquisitions. They look about digital transformation. They talk about business model changes. How are you helping the company with these kind of aspects? "I'm a black belt. I do the make. We know better than you." Those programs died, and died in a very sudden, violent death. At one point, especially when a new CEO came and said, "Oh, you're dealing. I can't deal with these things. Out," and he killed the program. But then CI leaders that they were able to see that things are evolving, the needs of the companies evolving. They understood that the skill set was not enough. And it was a difficult realization for them. It was a kind of a painful realization, but it was the ones who survived were the ones that said, "Okay, how do I position now my team in this environment to help the organization achieve its objectives?" So maybe they need to be project managers. Maybe I need to bring some digital transformation skill set, some business model skill set in the company. And they use a mix of recruitment and upskilling the people in the organization to continue be relevant for the company and be useful for the company. And these are the ones that survived.
Yeah. Every CI program is born under a set of business factors and circumstances, right? Maybe a company is having a challenge with costs and quality. So the program is conceived and deployed to address cost and quality. Maybe it's about acquiring and integrating acquired companies. And maybe, that's what they're all about. Maybe it's about reliability and uptime. They have to make sure their machines are running all the time and, producing reliable output. Maybe it's health and safety. Whatever the biggest pain point is usually where is the orientation of the CI program. But the challenge is that business factors and circumstances change over time, right? You got the business cycle. And if you don't, level set your program against the existing business factors periodically, you're going to find that you're working on things that are no longer important. So to your point, if your program is not evolving and not monitoring its strategic orientation and organization, it's going to be incrementally further and further on the outside, completely misaligned. And I would put the fault or blame, blame is forgotten small children, so I don't like to necessarily blame, but the root cause would be that the CI director is not taking the time to make sure that they're still working on what's important. Because there's things happening in the C-suite that the CI director might not be aware of. Okay. And unless the CI director actually reaches out and make sure that they still have a pulse on what's important, they're going to be on the outside. But the other challenge here is that oftentimes there's a barrier between the CI director and the C-suite. They don't talk to one another. They don't share. And under those circumstances, it's very difficult for the CI director, if they're not being told what's important, it's very hard for that a CI director to try to figure out what's important and to make sure that they're still working on that, which is important.
You are absolutely right. Actually, some of the strongest silos I've seen are at C-suite, where each one is protecting his territory. Each one doesn't want the other person to look into their area or their kingdom. And you don't have this kind of communication. You don't have this fluidity, this cross-functional collaboration that says, we are a value chain at the end of the day. So we need to be able to ensure the chain is well connected to deliver profitable and good service to the customers. And you're absolutely right. And sometimes I've seen companies trying to have a CI sponsor who is an executive C-suite member just to maintain this kind of connection. But then what I see maybe half the times even more, the person who is the CI sponsor might not necessarily be the most respected, reputable person. So you start thinking about, okay, this gives you a signal maybe about the program, how the program is being perceived. And that was a big mistake that we made, many mistakes. But one thing that results to what you described yourself is what I've seen is how the programs are being staffed. And what do I mean? Many companies position CI when it's launched for the first time as a catapult for future management positions. The stars of the company will come, will train you, and then you will go and change the company. Right. So they go and they target the top young guns, let's say. They teach them the technical stuff, and they think, if I know the technical stuff, I will rule the world, basically. The best CI people I've seen, is seasoned professionals that join the CI program. Right. People who understood the business, were respected by the business. And actually, in one of my previous assignments, I was put in tandem with such a person because he would teach me about the business and I would teach him about methodology. Because most of the times, these people don't come in the program because they hear, they want to teach me statistics. Why? I don't want to learn these things. I'm going to waste my time. And they stay away. But these are the people that you want to bring in because these can act as coaches and mentors to your top young guns, or how you want to call them, that you bring in, and they can ensure to keep you fixed to the business priorities because they came from the business.
Right.
And this was the strongest CI professionals I've met. The seasoned professional, business professionals who joined to structure their approach and the mindset. Huh? And then they always maintain this business perspective.
Right. And I think it's important because, made mention about some CI people being a bit full of themselves. I'll just boil it down. It's not the CI director's responsibility to get senior leaders to start thinking like them. It's important for the CI directors to start thinking like the senior leaders. Okay, you made mention about statistics. If you don't need to learn statistics, why do you have to learn statistics? For instance, in high school, I learned trigonometry. Maybe you did too. I have not used trigonometry since the end of that class. All right. So, for me and my career path and what I had to do to add value, trigonometry is something that was a waste. if you will. Mm. Now, if I come across a problem that requires trigonometry, I'm going to find the guy or gal that knows trigonometry. All right. But this is not something that a skill set that I have to embed in myself in order to be successful. So, you know, I think that it's important for senior leaders to understand the value proposition of continuous improvement methodologies. But should they be able to do a green belt project? I mean, why? You know, that's not their core value proposition. You know, if there is a why, if there is an answer to that why, if they, you know, there is an actual valuable output for that person to learn how to do a green belt project, by all means. But it's got to be a demonstrable why, not just, you know, because. But I think it is important for the senior leaders to be aware of the program, what its intended achievements are going to be, what its success factors are, what its approach, budget, return on that budget, the business factors. And it would probably be helpful to understand at the macro level the processes involved. But I'm not quite convinced, unless there's actually a value for that person to learn that skill, that they should learn that skill.
You're absolutely right. It goes to the point we're making about the beginning about the waste and why you are doing things. And what I've seen linked to that as a consequence is, especially when they were launching the CI Lean Six Sigma, I remember it was beginning of 2000 also, that many financial services companies start to jump in and they say, let's try to do it and things like that. And things were getting wrong from the beginning, because first is the big why you are doing it, what you want to achieve,
right?
Fine. Make sure that everybody understands the same thing and the understanding is correct. We're not fooling ourselves. And then there was a lot of perception that still exists today that the program starts by saying, do it like GE, do it like Jack Welch, do it like Toyota. Well, you can tell me to do it like Usain Bolt, but I cannot run like Usain Bolt. Never, ever. So you need to understand where you are. You need to take an honest assessment of where you are, what your capabilities, what you want to achieve, see what is out there, take it, and keep the principles and adapt all the rest. Okay. Right. Maybe you don't need all the tools. Maybe you don't want this framework like that. Keep the principles about collaboration, about based decision making. Keep these things that are in the core. Walk the process and have proximity with what happens on the shop floor. Keep the principles, but everything else, you need to adapt. Someone said, GE trained everybody. We have to go and train everybody ourselves. No, I don't know. That's not the starting point.
And if somebody makes that argument or that statement, you know, an argument and a statement are the same thing. You know, I don't mean argument as in quarrel. I just mean makes that argument. My immediate question would be, why? Why does everybody have to be trained? Maybe there's actually a tangible benefit, okay? But you better be able to tell me what that tangible benefit is, not just say that everybody's got to be trained. I mean, you know, when these disciplines become dogma, okay, when we start adapting them unquestioningly and everybody's got to be a believer, I think that's where, you know, there's great peril. Because then, you know, if everybody's thinking the same, then nobody's thinking. You know, that's really what it comes down to. I think George Patton said that. And, you know, to your point about, you know, having skill sets, I think it was Clint Eastwood that said, you know, a man's got to know his limitations, right? So, you know, I know my limitations. I shared one, trigonometry, all right? So that's definitely a limitation. And there was another commercial that, you know, this is for the audience. They could look this up. This is that you might actually use this in a presentation. There was a Dos Equis commercial, world's most interesting man, all right? And I don't know if you've seen the commercials there, Morpheus, but, you know, the world's most interesting man, you know, he's a smart, a swarthy looking guy. You know, he's got gray hair and, you know, he looks like me, except without glasses. And anyway, he's sitting in a leather chair in a mahogany room, and there's always a theme to the commercial. And this one is on careers. So it's like a little on careers, and they zoom into him, and he says, find out in life what you don't do well, and then don't do that thing. All right? So you think about this. If we want people to all become green belts, black belts, lean senseis, whatever it might be. First, do they actually have to learn that skill set? And if so, why? And the second is, actually, is that something that they're capable of learning? People may or may not be able to understand the concepts of Lean and Six Sigma, certainly not readily. Certainly when we get into the higher levels of statistical analysis, you're going to leave a lot of people behind because, it's just not their thing. But here we are trying to teach them, the inner workings without them having the aptitude to either absorb it or use it. And I think that's waste.
You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. And I think another point that, if I remember well, in one of the conferences we were elaborating a lot, is at which point the CI program can be pragmatic and manage a relationship with the senior stakeholders to say what it can be done, right, and what can be done. Because quite often you fall into the trap, early painful experience. We can do everything. We can do that. You don't want to disappoint, or you don't want to sound that you cannot deliver something. So whatever they ask, you say, yes, we can do it. And of course, you cannot do everything. Yeah. You cannot do everything because maybe your skill set doesn't match with the problem, or maybe you are over-promising of what can be achieved in a reasonable amount of time. And then this is where your credibility starts a little bit to chip away step by step, and then people in the end, they lose faith.
Yeah, and of course, if you're over-promising and under-delivering, you lose credibility, not just in yourself and your ability to be taken at your word, but also the credibility of the entirety of what you're responsible for. So if you're the director of CI and you're promising the world on no budget, and whenever somebody says no problem, as soon as they say that, I know there's going to be a problem. As soon as they get into the setting these false expectations, and as soon as they start not meeting these expectations, doom awaits. That's all there is to that. But the thing is, what do they say? Experience is the hardest teacher. It gives you the test first and teaches you the lesson afterwards. So if you're not used, if you're not in this leadership position before, if you haven't been punched in the mouth before, then you don't know what to expect the first time you're punched in the mouth. So, that person that is all of a sudden finding themselves in charge of a CI OPEX program and they've never done it before, they're going to have a tendency to minimize what it's going to take to achieve what it is that they want, that they have promised. It's just human nature. We think we could do more than we can in given the resources in time, talent, and money that are at our disposal. It's just human nature until we gain that experience. And then we become, more pragmatic in our approach. And our second stint as a CI director someplace is going to be much more successful.
You're right. And this is where the seasoned professionals help when you bring them in, when you are able to bring them and infuse them, that can give you this kind of perspective. Yeah. And as you correctly said, you can do webinars, you can read books, you can be in classrooms, some lessons you teach them by experiencing them.
Right.
And then you make sure next time not to make the same mistake. One of my favorite opening lines going to company or to executive for the first time is starting by saying, I'm not Harry Potter, and we, and especially you, have to work very hard for the improvements. Because there is also the perception quite often. And again, we don't necessarily challenge enough, because we may think that if we challenge, we might be perceived negatively or not good enough. Right. But there's no such thing that I bring people in and they solve the problem for me. There's no such thing. These things don't work like that. I'm here to educate, facilitate, help, work hands-on, of course, because you don't have knowledge capabilities at the beginning. But you have to work with me in order to solve the problem. You cannot just delegate your problems.
Right.
Another mistake, sometimes I think if I was to pick one attribute for a CI leader, I would choose courage above all. The courage to be able to have honest discussions. Honest discussions with his or her team about where they are, what they can do, what they're doing well. A courageous discussion with the C-suite about what they understand, what they don't understand, and how they contribute to the problem. And this is one attribute that, unfortunately, is on scarcity. Because
I think you missed one courage. The courage to listen when people are telling you and trying to share wisdom with you. I mean, it's one thing to have the courage for us to have the honest conversations with others, but they have to have the courage to be able to listen to what others are telling us.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. Yeah. I'm listening to you, JP. I forgot it. You are absolutely right.
So you know, as we work our ways through this pandemic, and certainly many companies, if not all companies, found themselves in less than a state of readiness. Right? As you get through this, as these companies get through this, what do you think is going to come out at the other end? You know, what transformational change in the approach of CI and OpEx might there be within organizations as they reconstitute their programs?
Well, let's assume that the normality, or what we consider normality before, does not come back soon. Let's say that for the next 2 to 3 years, you do have the social distancing that you need to have. You need to have certain measures, take care of certain things. A big challenge that I see, and especially for me, I've been used these kind of programs to be run with a lot of proximity, physical proximity, human proximity. I mean, CI, if we talk about this is a program that transforms an organization, changes the way things have been done, helps people see things differently. In the core of such a program, you need to have trust and respect between the people.
Yeah.
Okay? And we are used to build this trust and respect from the face-to-face interaction, from jointly experiencing things. Me and you will not have this kind of good discussion right now if we haven't spent time in conferences together, bonding, discussing, exchanging. So something that is a question mark currently, it is a question mark I have. I'm trying to figure it out. And there's a lot of cultural elements. I can tell you Northern Europe and South Europe are completely different environments to be. How do you create this kind of trust, this kind of bond, this kind of respect between the people that is the nucleus for them to work in a transparent, open way to change things in the organization? And this will be a huge barrier and a big puzzle to unlock for organizations.
Yeah, I think there's going to have to be a balance that is struck, between social distancing and building relationships. Because at the end of the day, people don't make decisions based on data. Okay, data helps them to make that decision, but ultimately they make a decision when their level of confidence exceeds their level of fear. There's no amount of data analysis of that data which can absolutely guarantee an outcome, right? I mean, they're just not possible. So every decision we make is a bet. It's a wager. And that means that the more we trust and respect and understand our colleagues, the quicker we're going to be able to make sound decisions, right? Yeah. Which means that if we're all working separately, remotely, that ability to create those bonds diminishes. So I'm going to believe that somewhere along the line, over the next couple of years, people and corporations are going to put in place actual mechanisms for social bonding within an organization. Yeah. And it might not, I'm not just talking about, one day a month we all get together at the office. I'm talking about one day a month we go on a hike. Or we go and learn something for half a day and then just, do something social for the rest of the day. Maybe it's a boat trip or something. Who knows what it is? But something in some surroundings where we can put down our, corporate airs and just be able to have real conversations and, you know, reinforce and or build that trust between and amongst colleagues. I'm going to guess that that is actually going to be part of the end process, but we're not there yet because we haven't been in it long enough. We've only been in 4 months or 5 months, whatever it is. So we don't know what the long-term effects of social distancing are, is, you know, from a human perspective. And that'll be something that's going to be interesting to see come out.
I was talking about this to a psychologist, and I was saying people talk about the new generation, the millennia, that is all with the tablets and smartphones. And there's this joke of two people sitting on a bench, and they don't talk to each other of what they see. They text. And I'm thinking, and I'm saying, you know, forcing you, in quotations, to be in the office, get the metro or the bus, go to the office, see people, talk to people, communicate with people, is part of building this kind of social interaction, of empathy, of our ability to communicate. Now, if we go into this more and remote working, because now we love it, and COVID, no COVID, we want to keep it, I will exaggerate to make a point. So you wake up in the morning, 8 o'clock, you sit in your office alone to work. Then after you finish the work, you have to be on Instagram, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, on TikTok, WhatsApp, whatever you have to be on to talk to. You arrive at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the evening, and then maybe you will do a video call and then all around again. I mean, this kind of lack of socialization, it will have an effect eventually.
Yeah.
You cannot avoid it. And this is what the scary part behind. And that's one part. And maybe I'm old school. I don't know. I like my work to be different from my office. And I want to have a gap between work and an office as a detox, you know.
Right.
You leave an office, a difficult day in the office. You have half an hour until you go to home. By the time you arrive, you have cleaned your mind. You can spend some time with your family.
Yep.
Now, you have a difficult call now. You finish, you go out of the door, you have to deal with your five-year-old child. I don't want to do that.
You know, I've been working out of my home now for 10 years, all right? And I got to tell you something. You know, it's a stupid little thing I do every day. Everybody thinks I'm crazy. But every day, I go for a drive, you know, 5, 10, 15-minute drive. When I come back, I go to my office and it's time to work. And at the end of the day, I do the same thing. And I come home and now it's time for family or not work. All right. And it's, you know, because for all my career up until 10 years ago, I would drive to the office and then I would drive home. All right. And I used that time driving to the office to make that mental transition from not working to working and driving home from working to not working. So it was like a physical, mental barrier that I wall I put up, and I find that that's the only way I can do it. Even still, otherwise, they all blend together. You know, the time just blends together. So, anyway, just a little stupid little thing that I've done. Yeah,
I very much understand you. It is a process to prepare yourself for the next step.
Yes.
You're absolutely right. Absolutely right.
So do you have any one word, we'll get to wrap up here, but do you have any one word of wisdom or idea or suggestion for CI directors and CI practitioners and or even senior leaders as we work through this and want to reinvigorate or reconstitute our CI programs?
Well, I think if I was to summarize almost everything that we said, would be... you have to understand and serve the business needs. That's it.
Yeah.
That's your job.
Excellent.
Understand Excellent. And serve.
Well, listen, Marcus, it was a real great pleasure to finally get you on my podcast. I appreciate it a great deal. You've been an outstanding guest and a great friend and colleague over these years we've known each other. So I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing your wisdom with my audience.
Oh, thank you very much, JP. I very much enjoyed the discussion and thank you for this opportunity. And I'm taking a note. It should not take us 2 years to schedule the next one.
Well, hopefully we won't have social isolation for the next 2 years and we'll see each other in a conference or in our travels sometime sure. between now and then. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, JP. Thank you.
You've been listening to another episode of State of Readiness. I'm your host, Joseph Paris, and you've been listening to Morpheus Chilicodus. I hope I got that right the second time, too. Thank you very much.